almost making him jump out of his skin. Laurie had laughed, had said, "Check out Jack, Smokey. I think he just went wee-wee in his tough skins." Smokey had given her a narrow, unsmiling look and motioned Jack over. Told Jack that was the payday whistle at the Oatley T&W. Told Jack that a whistle very much like it was going off at Dogtown Rubber, a company that made beach toys, inflatable rubber dolls, and condoms with names like Ribs of Delight. Soon, he said, the Oatley tap would begin filling up. "And you and me and Laurie and Gloria are going to move just as fast as lightning," Smokey said, "because when the eagle screams on Friday, we got to make up for what this place doesn't make every Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. When I tell you to run me out of keg, you want to have it out to me before I finish yelling. And you're in the men's room every half an hour with your mop. On Friday nights, a guy blows his groceries every 15 minutes or so." "I got the women's," Laurie said, coming over. Her hair was thin, wavy gold, her complexion as white as a comic book vampire's. She either had a cold or a bad coke habit. She kept sniffing. Jack guessed it was a cold. He doubted if anyone in Oatley could afford a bad coke habit. "Women ain't as bad as men, though. Almost, but not quite." "Shut up, Laurie." "Up yours," she said, and Smokey's hand flickered out like lightning. There was a crack, and suddenly the imprint of Smokey's palm was printed red on one of Laurie's pallid cheeks like a child's tattoodle. She began to snivel, but Jack was sickened and bewildered to see an expression in her eyes that was almost happy. It was the look of a woman who believed such treatment was a sign of caring. "You just keep hustling and we'll have no problem," Smokey said. "Remember to move fast when I yell for you to run me out of keg, and remember to get in the men's can with your mop every half an hour and clean up the puke." And then he had told Smokey again that he wanted to leave, and Smokey had reiterated his false promise about Sunday afternoon. But what good did it do to think of that? There were louder screams now, and harsh caws of laughter, the crunch of a breaking chair and a wavering yell of pain. A fistfight, the third of the night, had broken out on the dance floor. Smokey uttered a curse and shoved past Jack. "Get rid of that keg," he said. Jack got the empty onto the dolly and trundled it back toward the swinging door, looking around uneasily for Randolph Scott as he went. He saw the man standing in the crowd that was watching the fight and relaxed a little. In the storeroom, he put the empty keg with the others by the loading bay. Updike's Oatley tap had already gone through 6 kegs tonight. That done, he checked his pack again. For one panicky moment, he thought it was gone, and his heart began to hammer in his chest. The magic juice was in there, and so was the territory's coin that had become a silver dollar in this world. He moved to the right, sweat now standing out on his forehead, and felt between 2 more kegs. There it was. He could trace the curve of Speedy's bottle through the green nylon of the pack. His heartbeat began to slow down, but he felt shaky and rubber-legged, the way you feel after a narrow escape. The men's toilet was a horror. Earlier in the evening, Jack might have vomited in sympathy, but now he actually seemed to be getting used to the stench, and that was somehow the worst thing of all. He drew hot water, dumped in Comet, and began to run his soapy mop back and forth through the unspeakable mess on the floor. His mind began to go back over the last couple of days, worrying at them the way an animal in a trap will worry at a limb that has been caught. The Oatley tap had been dark and dingy and apparently dead empty when Jack first walked into it. The plugs on the juke, the pinball machine, and the Space Invaders game were all pulled. The only light in the place came from the bush display over the bar, a digital clock caught between the peaks of 2 mountains, looking like the weirdest UFO ever imagined. Smiling a little, Jack walked toward the bar. He was almost there when a flat voice said from behind him, "This is a bar, no miners. What are you, stupid? Get out!" Jack almost jumped out of his skin. He had been touching the money in his pocket, thinking it would go just as it had at the Golden Spoon. He would sit on a stool, order something, and then ask for the job. It was, of course, illegal to hire a kid like him, at least without a work permit signed by his parents or a guardian, and that meant they could get him for under the minimum wage. Way under. So the negotiations would start, usually beginning with story number 2, Jack and the Evil Stepfather. He whirled around and saw a man sitting alone in one of the booths, looking at him with chilly, contemptuous alertness. The man was thin, but ropes of muscles moved under his white undershirt and along the sides of his neck. He wore baggy white cook's pants. A paper cap was cocked forward over his left eyebrow. His head was narrow, weasel-like. His hair was cut short, graying at the edges. Between his big hands were a stack of invoices and a Texas Instruments calculator. "I saw your help wanted sign," Jack said, "but now without much hope. This man was not going to hire him, and Jack was not sure he would want to work for him anyway. This guy looked mean." "You did, huh?" the man in the booth said. "You must have learned to read on one of the days you weren't playing hooky." There was a package of Philly's cheroots on the table. He shook one out. "Well, I didn't know it was a bar," Jack said, taking a step back toward the door. The sunlight seemed to come through the dirty glass and then just fall dead on the floor, as if the Oatly tap were located in a slightly different dimension. "I guess I thought it was, you know, a bar and grill, something like that. I'll just be going." "Come here." The man's brown eyes were looking at him steadily now. "No, hey, that's all right," Jack said nervously. "I'll just come here. Sit down." The man popped a wooden match alight with his thumbnail and lit the cigar. A fly, which had been preening on his paper hat, buzzed away into the darkness. His eyes remained on Jack. "I ain't gonna bite you." Jack came slowly over to the booth, and after a moment he slipped in on the other side and folded his hands in front of him neatly. Some 60 hours later, swamping out the men's toilet at 12:30 in the morning with his sweaty hair hanging in his eyes, Jack thought, no, he knew that it was his own stupid confidence that had allowed the trap to spring shut, and it had shut the moment he sat down opposite Smokey Updike, although he had not known it then. The Venus flytrap is able to close on its hapless, insectile victims. The pitcher plant, with its delicious smell and its deadly, glassy, smooth sides, only waits for some flying asshole of a bug to buzz on down and inside, where it finally drowns in the rainwater the pitcher collects. In Oatly, the pitcher was full of beer instead of rainwater. That was the only difference. If he had run... But he hadn't run. And maybe, Jack thought, doing his best to meet that cold brown stare, there would be a job here after all. Minette Banbury, the woman who owned and operated the Golden Spoon in Auburn, had been pleasant enough to Jack, had even given him a little hug and a peck of a kiss, as well as 3 thick sandwiches when he left. But he had not been fooled. Pleasantness and even a remote sort of kindness did not preclude a cold interest in profits, or even something very close to outright greed. The minimum wage in New York was $3.40 an hour. That information had been posted in the Golden Spoon's kitchen by law on a bright pink piece of paper almost the size of a movie poster. But the short-order cook was a Haitian who spoke little English and was almost surely in the country illegally, Jack thought. The guy cooked like a whiz, though, never allowing the spuds or the fried clams to spend a moment too long in the fryolators. The girl who helped Mrs. Banbury with the waitressing was pretty but vacant, and on a work-release program for the retarded in Rome. In such cases, the minimum wage did not apply, and the lisping, retarded girl told Jack with unfeigned awe that she was getting $1.25 each hour, and all for her. Jack himself was getting $1.50. He had bargained for that, and he knew that if Mrs. Banbury hadn't been strapped, her old dishwasher had quit just that morning, had gone on his coffee break and just never come back, she would not have bargained at all, would simply have told him to take the buck and a quarter, kid, or see what's down the road. It's a free country. Now, he thought, with the unknowing cynicism that was also a part of his new self-confidence, here was another Mrs. Banbury. Male instead of female, rope skinny instead of fat and grandmotherly, sour instead of smiling, but almost surely a Mrs. Banbury for a that and a that. "Looking for a job, huh?" The man in the white pants and the paper hat put his cigar down in an old tin ashtray with the word Camels embossed on the bottom. The fly stopped washing its legs and took off. "Yes, sir, but like you say, this is a bar and all..." The unease stirred in him again. Those brown eyes and yellowed scleras troubled him. They were the eyes of some old hunting cat that had seen plenty of errant mice like him before. "Yeah, it's my place," the man said. "Smokey Updike." He held his hand out. Surprised, Jack shook it. It squeezed Jack's hand once, hard, almost to the point of pain, Then it relaxed, but Smokey didn't let go. "Well?" he said. "Huh?" Jack said, aware he sounded stupid and a little afraid. He felt stupid and a little afraid, and he wanted Updike to let go of his hand. "Didn't your folks ever teach you to introduce yourself?" This was so unexpected that Jack came close to gabbling out his real name instead of the one he had used at the Golden Spoon, the name he also used if the people who picked him up asked for his handle. That name, what he was coming to think of as his road name, was Lewis Farron. "Jack Sawtell," he said. Updike held his hand yet a moment longer, those brown eyes never moving. Then he let it go. "Jack Sawtell," he said. "Must be the longest fucking name in the phone book, huh, kid?" Jack flushed but said nothing. "You ain't very big," Updike said. "You think you could manage to rock a 90-pound keg of beer up on its side and walk it onto a hand dolly?" "I think so," Jack said, not knowing if he could or not. It didn't look as if it would be much of a problem anyway. In a place as dead as this, the guy probably only had to change kegs when the one hooked up to the taps went flat. As if reading his mind, Updike said, "Yeah, nobody here now. But we get pretty busy by 4 or 5 o'clock, and on weekends a place really fills up. That's when you'd earn your keep, Jack."
"Well, I don't know," Jack said. "How much would the job pay?"
"Dollar an hour," Updike said. "Wish I could pay you more, but..." He shrugged and tapped the stack of bills. He even smiled a little, as if to say, "You see how it is, kid. Everything in Oatley is running down like a cheap pocket watch someone forgot to wind. Ever since about 1971 it's been running down." But his eyes did not smile. His eyes were watching Jack's face with still, cat-like concentration.
"Gee, that's not very much," Jack said.
He spoke slowly, but he was thinking as fast as he could. The Oatley tap was a tomb. There wasn't even a single bombed-out old alky at the bar nursing a beer and watching General Hospital on the tube. In Oatley, you apparently drank in your car and called it a club. $1.50 an hour was a hard wage when you were busting your buns. In a place like this, $1 an hour might be an easy one. "Nope," Updike agreed, going back to his calculator. "It ain't." His voice said Jack could take it or leave it. There would be no negotiations.
"Might be all right," Jack said.
"Well, that's good," Updike said. "We ought to get one other thing straight, though. Who you running from and who's looking for you?" The brown eyes were on him again, and they drilled hard. "If you got someone on your back trail, I don't want him fucking up my life." This did not shake Jack's confidence much. He wasn't the world's brightest kid, maybe, but bright enough to know he wouldn't last long on the road without a second cover story for prospective employers. This was story number 2, The Wicked Stepfather.
"I'm from a little town in Vermont," he said, "Fenderville. My mom and dad got divorced 2 years ago. My dad tried to get custody of me, but the judge gave me to my mom. That's what they do most of the time."
"Fucking A, they do." He had gone back to his bills and was bent so far over the pocket calculator that his nose was almost touching the keys, but Jack thought he was listening all the same.
"Well, my dad went out to Chicago and he got a job in a plant out there," Jack said. "He writes to me just about every week, I guess, but he quit coming back last year when Aubrey beat him up."
"Aubrey's your stepfather," Updike said. And for just a moment, Jack's eyes narrowed and his original distrust came back. There was no sympathy in Updike's voice. Instead, Updike seemed almost to be laughing at him, as if he knew the whole tale was nothing but a great big swatch of whole cloth.
"Yeah," he said. "My mom married him 1.5 years ago. He beats on me a lot."
"Sad, Jack. Very sad." Now Updike did look up, his eyes sardonic and unbelieving. "So now you're off to Chi-Town, where you and Dad's will live happily ever after."
"Well, I hope so," Jack said, and he had a sudden inspiration. "All I know is that my real dad never hung me up by the neck in my closet."
He pulled down the neck of his T-shirt, bearing the mark there. It was fading now. During a stint at the Golden Spoon, it had still been a vivid, ugly red-purple, like a brand. But at the Golden Spoon, he'd never had occasion to uncover it. It was, of course, the mark left by the root that had nearly choked the life from him in that other world.
He was gratified to see Smoky Updike's eyes widen in surprise and what might almost have been shock. He leaned forward, scattering some of his pink and yellow pages.
"Holy Jesus, kid," he said. "Your stepfather did that?"
"That's when I decided I had to split."
"Is he going to show up here looking for his car or his motorcycle or his wallet or his fucking dope stash?"
Jack shook his head. Smokey looked at Jack for a moment longer and then pushed the off button on the calculator.
"Come on back to the storeroom with me, kid," he said.
"Why?"
"I want to see if you can really rock one of those kegs up on its side. If you can run me out a keg when I need one, you can have the job."
Jack demonstrated to Smokey Updike's satisfaction that he could get one of the big aluminum kegs up on its rim and walk it forward just enough to get it on the foot of the dolly. He even made it look fairly easy. Dropping a keg and getting punched in the nose was still a day away.
"Well, that ain't too bad," Updike said. "You ain't big enough for the job, and you'll probably give yourself a fucking rupture, but that's your never mind."
He told Jack he could start at noon and work through until 1 in the morning, for as long as you can hack it anyway. Jack would be paid, Updike said, at closing time each night, cash on the nail. They went back out front, and there was Lori, dressed in dark blue basketball shorts so brief that the edges of her rayon panty showed, and a sleeveless blouse that had almost surely come from Mammoth Mart in Batavia. Her thin blonde hair was held back with plastic barrettes, and she was smoking a Pall Mall, its end wet and heavily marked with lipstick. A large silver crucifix dangled between her breasts.
"This is Jack," Smokey said. "You can take the help wanted sign out of the window."
"Run, kid," Lori said. "There's still time."
"Shut the fuck up. Make me."
Updike slapped her butt, not in a loving way, but hard enough to send her against the padded edge of the bar. Jack blinked and thought of the sound Osmond's whip had made.
"Big man," Lori said.
Her eyes brimmed with tears, and yet they also looked contented, as if this was just the way things were supposed to be. Jack's earlier unease was now clearer, sharper. Now it was almost fright.
"Don't let us get on your case, kid," Lori said, headed past him to the sign in the window. "You'll be okay."
"Name's Jack, not Kid," Smokey said. He had gone back to the booth where he had interviewed Jack and began gathering up his bills.
"A kid's a fucking baby goat. Didn't they teach you that in school? Make the kid a couple of burgers. He's got to go to work at 4.
She got the help wanted sign out of the window and put it behind the jukebox with the air of one who has done this a good many times before. Passing Jack, she winked at him. The telephone rang. All three of them looked toward it, startled by its abrupt shrilling. To Jack, it looked for a moment like a black slug stuck to the wall. It was an odd moment, almost timeless. He had time to notice how pale Lori was. The only color in her cheeks came from the reddish pox of her fading adolescent acne. He had time to study the cruel, rather secretive planes of Smokey Updike's face, and to see the way the veins stood out on the man's long hands. Time to see the yellowed sign over the phone reading, "Please limit your calls to 3 minutes." The phone rang and rang in the silence. Jack thought, suddenly terrified, "It's for me. Long distance. Long, long distance."
"Answer that, Lori," Updike said. "What are you, simple?"
Lori went to the phone.
"Oatley Tap,"
she said in a trembling, faint voice. She listened.
"Hello? Hello? Oh, fuck off!"
She hung up with a bang.
"No one there. Kids. Sometimes they want to know if we got Prince Albert in a can. How do you like your burgers, kid?"
"Jack!" Updike roared.
"Jack, okay, okay, Jack. How do you like your burgers, Jack?"
Jack told her, and they came medium, just right, hot with brown mustard and Bermuda onions. He gobbled them and drank a glass of milk. His unease abated with his hunger. "Kids," she had said. Still, his eyes drifted back to the phone every once in a while, and he wondered. 4 o'clock came. And as if the tap's total emptiness had been only a clever piece of stage setting to lure him in, like the pitcher plant with its innocent look and its tasty smell, The door opened, and nearly a dozen men in work clothes came sauntering in. Lori plugged in the juke, the pinball machine, and Space Invaders game. Several of the men bellowed greetings at Smokey, who grinned his narrow grin, exposing the big set of mail-order dentures. Most ordered beer. Two or three ordered Black Russians. One of them, a member of the Fair Weather Club, Jack was almost sure, dropped quarters into the jukebox, summoning up the voices of Mickey Gilly, Eddie Rabbit, Waylon Jennings, others. Smokey told him to get the mop bucket and squeegee out of the storeroom and swab down the dance floor in front of the bandstand, which waited, deserted, for Friday Night and the Jenny Valley Boys. He told Jack when it was dry he wanted him to put the pledge right to it. "You'll know it's done when you can see your own face grinning up at you," Smokey said. So his time of service at Updike's Oatly Tap began. We get pretty busy by 4 or 5 o'clock. Well, he couldn't very well say that Smokey had lied to him. Up until the very moment Jack pushed away his plate and began making his wage, the tap had been deserted. But by 6 o'clock there were maybe 50 people in the tap, and a brawny waitress, Gloria, came on duty to yells and hoorahs from some of the patrons. Gloria joined Lori, serving a few carafes of wine, a lot of Black Russians, and oceans of beer. Besides the kegs of Busch, Jack lugged out case after case of bottled beer, Budweiser, of course, but also such local favorites as Genesee, Utica Club, and Rolling Rock. His hands began to blister, his back to ache. Between trips to the storeroom for cases of bottled beer and trips to the storeroom to run me out of keg, Jack, a phrase for which he was already coming to feel an elemental dread, he went back to the dance floor, the mop bucket, and the big bottle of pledge. Once an empty beer bottle flew past his head, missing him by inches. He ducked, heart racing, as it shattered against the wall. Smokey ran the drunken perpetrator out, his dentures bared in a great false alligator grin. Looking out the window, Jack saw the drunk hit a parking meter hard enough to pop the red violation flag up. "Come on, Jack," Smokey called impatiently from the bar. "It missed you, didn't it? Clean that mess up." Smokey sent him into the men's can half an hour later. A middle-aged man with a Joe Pine haircut was standing woozily at one of the two ice-choked urinals, one hand braced against the wall, the other brandishing a huge, uncircumcised penis. A puddle of puke steamed between his spraddled work boots. "Clean her up, kid," the man said, weaving his way back toward the door and clapping Jack on the back almost hard enough to knock him over. "Man's got to make room any way he can, right?" Jack was able to wait until the door closed, and then he could control his gorge no longer. He managed to make it into the tap's only stall, where he was faced with the unflushed and sickeningly fragrant spoor of the last customer. Jack vomited up whatever remained of his dinner, took a couple of hitching breaths, and then vomited again. He groped for the flush with a shaking hand and pushed it. Waylon and Willie thudded dully through the walls, singing about Luckenbach, Texas. Suddenly his mother's face was before him, more beautiful than it had ever been on any movie screen, her eyes large and dark and sorrowing. He saw her alone in their rooms at the Alhambra, a cigarette smoldering, forgotten in the ashtray beside her. She was crying, crying for him. His heart seemed to hurt so badly that he thought he would die from love for her and want of her. For a life where there were no things in tunnels, no women who somehow wanted to be slapped and made to cry, no men who vomited between their own feet while taking a piss. He wanted to be with her, and hated Speedy Parker with a black completeness for ever having set his foot on this awful road west. In that moment, whatever might have remained of his self-confidence was demolished. It was demolished utterly and forever. Conscious thought was overmastered by a deep, elemental, wailing, childish cry. "I want my mother, please, God, I want my mother!" He trembled his way out of the stall on watery legs, thinking, "Okay, that's it, everybody out of the pool, fuck you, Speedy, this kid's going home, or whatever you want to call it." In that moment, he didn't care if his mother might be dying. In that moment of inarticulate pain, he became totally Jack's Jack, as unconsciously self-serving as an animal on which any carnivore may prey, deer, rabbit, squirrel, chipmunk. In that moment, he would have been perfectly willing to let her die of the cancer metastasizing wildly outward from her lungs if only she would hold him and then kiss him goodnight and tell him not to play his goddamn transistor in bed or read with a flashlight under the covers for half the night. He put his hand against the wall and little by little managed to get hold of himself. This taking hold was no conscious thing, but a simple tightening of the mind, something that was very much Phil Sawyer and Lily Cavanaugh. He'd made a mistake, yeah, but he wasn't going back. The territories were real, and so the talisman might also be real. He was not going to murder his mother with faint-heartedness. Jack filled his mop bucket with hot water from the spigot in the storeroom and cleaned up the mess. When he came out again, it was 10:30, and the crowd in the tap began to thin out. Oatley was a working town, and its working drinkers went home early on weeknights. Laurie said, "You look as pale as pastry, Jack. You okay?" "Do you think I could have a ginger ale?" he asked. She brought him one, and Jack drank it while he finished waxing the dance floor. At 11:45, Smokey ordered him back to the storeroom to run out a keg. Jack managed the keg, barely. At 12:45, Smokey started bawling for people to finish up. Laurie unplugged the juke. Dick Curless died with a long, unwinding groan to a few half-hearted cries of protest. Gloria unplugged the games, donned her sweater — it was as pink as the Canada Mint Smokey ate regularly, as pink as the false gums of his dentures — and left. Smokey began to turn out the lights and to urge the last 4 or 5 drinkers out the door. "Okay, Jack," he said when they were gone, "you did good. There's room for improvement, but you gotta start anyway. You can doss down in the storeroom." Instead of asking for his pay, which Smokey did not offer anyway, Jack stumbled off toward the storeroom, so tired that he looked like a slightly smaller version of the drunk so lately ushered out. In the storeroom, he saw Laurie squatting down in one corner. The squat caused her basketball shorts to ride up to a point that was nearly alarming, and for a moment Jack thought with dull alarm that she was going through his knapsack. Then he saw that she had spread a couple of blankets on a layer of burlap apple sacks. Laurie had also put down a small satin pillow which said "New York World's Fair" on one side. "Thought I'd make you a little nest, kid," she said. "Thanks," he said. It was a simple, almost offhand act of kindness, but Jack found himself having to struggle from bursting into tears. He managed a smile instead. "Thanks a lot, Laurie." "No problem. You'll be all right here, Jack. Smokey ain't so bad. Once you get to know him, he ain't half bad." She said this with an unconscious wistfulness, as if wishing it were so. "Probably not," Jack said. And then he added impulsively, "But I'm moving on tomorrow. Oatley's just not for me, I guess." She said, "Maybe you'll go, Jack, and maybe you'll decide to stay a while. Why don't you sleep on it?" There was something forced and unnatural about this little speech. It had none of the genuineness of her grin when she'd said, "Thought I'd make you a little nest." Jack noticed it, but was too tired to do more than that. "Well, we'll see," he said. "Sure we will," Laurie agreed, going to the door. She blew a kiss toward him from the palm of one dirty hand. "Good night, Jack." "Good night." He started to pull off his shirt, and then left it on, deciding he would just take off his sneakers. The storeroom was cold and chilly. He sat down on the apple sacks, pulled the knots, pushed off first one and then the other. He was about to lie back on Laurie's New York World's Fair souvenir, and he might well have been sound asleep before his head ever touched it, when the telephone began to ring out in the bar, shrilling into the silence, drilling into it, making him think of wavering, pasty gray roots and bullwhips and two-headed ponies. Ring, ring, ring into the silence, into the dead silence. Ring, 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 long after the kids who call up to ask about Prince Albert and a can have gone to bed. Ring, ring, ring. Hello, Jackie, it's Morgan. And I felt you in my woods, you smart little shit. I smelled you in my woods. And how did you ever get the idea that you were safe in your world? My woods are there, too. Last chance, Jackie, get home, or we send out the troops. You won't have a chance. You won't. Jack got up and ran across the storeroom floor in his stocking feet. A light sweat that felt freezing cold seemed to cover his entire body. He opened the door a crack. Ring, 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 ring. Then finally, hello, Oatly Tap, and this better be good. Smokey's voice. A pause. Hello. Another pause. Fuck off. Smokey hung up with a bang, and Jack heard him recross the floor and then start up the stairs to the small overhead apartment he and Laurie shared. Jack looked unbelievingly from the green slip of paper in his left hand to the small pile of bills, all ones, and change by his right. It was 11 o'clock the next morning, Thursday morning, and he had asked for his pay. "What is this?" he asked, still unable to believe it.
"You can read," Smokey said, "and you can count. You don't move as fast as I'd like, Jack, at least not yet. But you're bright enough."
Now he sat with the green slip in one hand and the money by the other. Dull anger began to pulse in the middle of his forehead like a vein. "Guest check," the green slip was headed. It was the exact same form Mrs. Banbury had used in the Golden Spoon. It read, "One hamburger, $1.35. One hamburger, $1.35. One large milk, 55 cents. One gin ale, 55 cents. Tax, 30 cents. At the bottom, the figure $4.10 was written in large numbers and circled. Jack had made $9 for his 4-to-1 stint. Smokey had charged off nearly half of it. What he had left by his right hand was $4.90. He looked up, furious, first at Laurie, who looked away as if vaguely embarrassed, and then at Smokey, who simply looked back. "This is a cheat," he said thinly.
"Jack, that's not true. Look at the menu prices. That's not what I mean, and you know it."
Laurie flinched a little, as if expecting Smokey to clout him one, but Smokey only looked at Jack with a kind of terrible patience.
"I didn't charge you for your bed, did I?"
"Bed?" Jack shouted, feeling the hot blood boil up into his cheeks. "Some bed! Cut open burlap bags on a concrete floor! Some bed! I'd like to see you try to charge me for it, you dirty cheat!" Laurie made a scared sound and shot a look at Smokey. But Smokey only sat across from Jack in the booth, the thick blue smoke of a cheroot curling up between them. A fresh paper fry cook's hat was cocked forward on Smokey's narrow head.
"We talked about you dossing down back there," Smokey said. "You asked if it came with a job. I said it did. No mention was made of your meals. If it had been brought up, maybe something could have been done. Maybe not. Point is, you never brought it up, so now you got to deal with that."
Jack sat shaking, tears of anger standing in his eyes. He tried to talk, and nothing came out but a small, strangled groan. He was literally too furious to speak.
"Of course, if you wanted to discuss an employee's discount on your meals..."
"Now, go to hell," Jack managed finally, snatching up the four singles and the little strew of change. "Teach the next kid who comes in here how to look out for number one. I'm going." He crossed the floor toward the door, and in spite of his anger, he knew, did not just think, but flat out knew, that he wasn't going to make the sidewalk.
"Jack..."
He touched the doorknob, thought of grasping it and turning it, but that voice was undeniable and full of a certain threat. He dropped his hand and turned around, his anger leaving him. He suddenly felt shrunken and old. Laurie had gone behind the bar where she was sweeping and humming. She had apparently decided that Smokey wasn't going to work Jack over with his fists, and since nothing else really mattered, everything was all right.
"You don't want to leave me in the lurch with my weekend crowd coming up."
"I want to get out of here. You cheated me."
"No, sir," Smokey said. "I explained that. If anyone blotted your copybook, Jack, it was you. Now, we could discuss your meals, 50% off the food, maybe, and even free sodas.
I never went that far before with the younger help I hire from time to time, but this weekend's going to be especially hairy, what with all the migrant labor in the county for the apple picking. And I like you, Jack. That's why I didn't clout you one when you raised your voice to me, although maybe I should have. But I need you over the weekend.
Jack felt his rage return briefly, and then die away again.
"What if I go anyhow?" he asked. "I'm $5 to the good anyway, and being out of this shitty little town might be just as good as a bonus."
Looking at Jack, still smiling his narrow smile, Smokey said, "You remember going into the men's last night to clean after some guy who whoopsed his cookies?" Jack nodded.
"You remember what he looked like?
Crew cut, khakis, so what?"
"That's Digger Atwell. His real name's Carlton, but he spent 10 years taking care of the town cemetery, so everyone got calling him Digger. That was, 20, 30 years ago. He went on the town cops back around the time Nixon got elected president. Now he's chief of police."
Smokey picked up his cheroot, puffed at it, and looked at Jack.
"Digger and me go back," Smokey said. "And if you was to just walk out of here now, Jack, I couldn't guarantee that you wouldn't have some trouble with Digger. Might end up getting sent home. Might end up picking the apples on the town's land. Oatley Township's got, I guess 40 acres of good trees. Might end up getting beat up. Or, I've heard that old Digger's got a taste for kids on the road. Boys, mostly."
Jack thought of that club-like penis. He felt both sick and cold.
"In here, you're under my wing, so to speak," Smokey said. "Once you hit the street, who can say? Digger's apt to be cruising any place. You might get over the town line with no sweat. On the other hand, you might just see him pulling up beside you in that big Plymouth he drives. Digger ain't totally bright, but he does have a nose sometimes. Or someone might give him a call."
Behind the bar, Lori was doing dishes. She dried her hands, turned on the radio, and began to sing along with an old Steppenwolf song.
"Tell you what," Smokey said. "Hang in there, Jack. Work the weekend. Then I'll pack you into my pickup and drive you over the town line myself. How would that be? You'll go out of here Sunday noon with damn near $30 in your poke that you didn't have coming in. You'll go out thinking that Oatley's not such a bad place after all. So what do you say?"
Jack looked into those brown eyes, noted the yellow scleras and the small flecks of red. He noted Smokey's big, sincere smile, lined with false teeth. He even saw, with a weird and terrifying sense of déjà vu, that the fly was back on the paper fry cook's hat, preening and washing its hair-thin forelegs. He suspected Smokey knew that he knew that everything Updike had said was a lie, and didn't even care. After working into the early hours of Saturday morning and then Sunday morning, Jack would sleep until maybe 2 Sunday afternoon. Smokey would tell him he couldn't give him that ride because Jack had woken up too late. Now he, Smokey, was too busy watching the Colts and the Patriots. And Jack would not only be too tired to walk, he would be too afraid that Smokey might lose interest in the Colts and Patriots just long enough to call his good friend Digger Atwell and say, "He's walking down Mill Road right now, Digger, old boy. Why don't you pick him up? Then get over here for the second half. Free beer. But don't you go puking in my urinal until I get the kid back here." That was one scenario. There were others that he could think of, each a little different, each really the same at bottom. Smokey Updike's smile widened a little.
Chapter 10. Elroy. "When I was 6,
the tap, which had begun to wind down by this time on his previous 2 nights, was roaring along as if the patrons expected to greet the dawn. He saw 2 tables had vanished, victims of the fistfight that had broken out just before his last expedition into the John. Now people were dancing where the tables had been. "About time," Smokey said as Jack staggered the length of the bar on the inside and put the case down by the refrigerator compartments.
"You get those in there and go back for the fucking bud. You should have brought that first anyway."
Lori didn't say hot, incredible pain exploded in his foot as Smokey drove one heavy shoe down on Jack's sneaker. Jack uttered a muffled scream and felt tears sting his eyes.
"Shut up," Smokey said. "Lori don't know shit from Shinola, and you are smart enough to know it. Get back in there and run me out a case of bud." He went back to the storeroom, limping on the foot Smokey had stomped, wondering if the bones in some of his toes might be broken. It seemed all too possible. His head roared with the smoke and noise and the jagged ripsaw rhythm of the Jenny Valley Boys, two of them now noticeably weaving on the bandstand. One thought stood out clearly. It might not be possible to wait until closing. He really might not be able to last that long. If Oatley was a prison and the Oatley Tap was his cell, then surely exhaustion was as much his warder as Smokey Updike, maybe even more so. In spite of his worries about what the territories might be like at this place, the magic juice seemed more and more to promise him his only sure way out. He could drink some and flip over, and if he could manage to walk a mile west over there, two at the most, he could drink a bit more and flip back into the USA, well over the town line of this horrible little place, perhaps as far west as Bushville or even Pembroke. When I was six, when Jacko was six, when he got the bud and stumbled, staggered out through the door again. And the tall, rangy cowboy with the big hands, the one who looked like Randolph Scott, was standing there looking at him. "Hello, Jack," he said. And Jack saw with rising terror that the irises of the man's eyes were as yellow as chicken claws. "Didn't somebody tell you to get gone? You don't listen very good, do you?" Jack stood with a case of bud dragging at the ends of his arms, staring into those yellow eyes, and suddenly a horrid idea hammered into his mind that this had been the lurker in the tunnel, this man-thing with its dead yellow eyes. "Leave me alone," he said. The words came out in a wintry little whisper. He crowded closer. "You were supposed to get gone." Jack tried to back up, but now he was against the wall, and as the cowboy who looked like Randolph Scott leaned toward him, Jack could smell dead meat on its breath. Between the time Jack started work on Thursday at noon and 4 o'clock, when the Tap's usual after-work crowd started to come in, the payphone with the "please limit your calls to 3 minutes" sign over it rang twice. The first time it rang, Jack felt no fear at all, and it turned out to be only a solicitor for the United Fund. 2 hours later, as Jack was bagging up the last of the previous night's bottles, the telephone began to shrill again. This time his head snapped up like an animal which scents fire in a dry forest, except it wasn't fire he sensed, but ice. He turned toward the telephone, which was only 4 feet from where he was working, hearing the tendons in his neck creak. He thought he must see the payphone caked with ice, ice that was sweating through the phone's black plastic case, extruding from the holes in the earpiece and the mouthpiece in lines of blue ice as thin as pencil leads, hanging from the rotary dial and the coin return in icicle beards. But it was just the phone, and all the coldness and death was on the inside. He stared at it, hypnotized. "Jack!" Smokey yelled. "Answer the goddamn phone! What the fuck am I paying you for?" Jack looked toward Smokey as desperate as a cornered animal. But Smokey was staring back with the thin-lipped, out-of-patience expression that he got on his face just before he popped Lori one. He started toward the phone, barely aware that his feet were moving. He stepped deeper and deeper into that capsule of coldness, feeling the goose flesh run up his arms, feeling the moisture crackle in his nose. He reached out and grasped the phone. His hand went numb. He put it to his ear. His ear went numb. "Oatley Tap," he said into that deadly blackness, and his mouth went numb. The voice that came out of the phone was the cracked, rasping croak of something long dead, some creature which could never be seen by the living. The sight of it would drive a living person insane, or strike him dead with frost etchings on his lips and staring eyes blinded by cataracts of ice. "Jack!" This scabrous, rattling voice whispered up out of the earpiece, and his face went numb, the way it did when you needed to spend a heavy day in the dentist chair and the guy needled you up with a little too much Novocaine. "You get your ass back home, Jack." From far away, a distance of light years, it seemed, he could hear his voice repeating, Oatley Tap, is anyone there? Hello? Hello?
Cold. So cold.
His throat was numb. He drew breath and his lungs seemed to freeze. Soon the chambers of his heart would ice up and he would simply drop dead.
That chilly voice whispered, "Bad things can happen to a boy alone on the road, Jack. Ask anybody."
He hung the phone up with a quick, clumsy, reaching gesture. He pulled his hand back and then stood looking at the phone. "Was it the asshole, Jack?" Laurie asked, and her voice was distant, but a little closer than his own voice had seemed a few moments ago. The world was coming back. On the handset of the payphone, he could see the shape of his hand, outlined in a glittering rhyme of frost. As he looked, the frost began to melt and run down the black plastic. That was the night, Thursday night, that Jack first saw Jenny County's answer to Randolph Scott. The crowd was a little smaller than it had been Wednesday night, very much a day-before-payday crowd, but there were still enough men present to fill the bar and spill over into the tables and booths. They were town men from a rural area where the plows were now probably rusting, forgotten in back sheds, men who perhaps wanted to be farmers but had forgotten how. There were a lot of John Deere caps in evidence, but to Jack, very few of these men looked as if they would be at home riding a tractor. These were men in gray chinos and brown chinos and green chinos, men with their names stitched on blue shirts and gold thread, men in square-toed dingo boots and men in great big clumping survivors. These men carried their keys on their belts. These men had wrinkles but no laugh lines. Their mouths were dour. These men wore cowboy hats, and when Jack looked at the bar from in back of the stools, there were as many as eight who looked like Charlie Daniels in the chewing tobacco ads. But these men didn't chew. These men smoked cigarettes, and a lot of them. Jack was cleaning the bubble front of the jukebox when Digger Atwell came in. The juke was turned off, the Yankees were on the cable, and the men at the bar were watching intently. The night before, Atwell had been in the Oatley male's version of sports clothes, chinos, khaki shirt with a lot of pens in one of the two big pockets, steel-toed work boots. Tonight he was wearing a blue cop's uniform. A large gun with wood grips hung in a holster on his creaking leather belt. He glanced at Jack, who thought of Smokey saying, "I've heard that old Digger's got a taste for kids on the road, boys mostly," and flinched back as if guilty of something. Digger Atwell grinned a wide, slow grin. "Decided to stick around for a while, boy?" "Yes, sir," Jack muttered, and squirted more Windex onto the juke's bubble front, although it was already as clean as it was going to get. He was only waiting for Atwell to go away. After a while, Atwell did. Jack turned to watch the beefy cop cross to the bar, and that was when the man at the far left end of the bar turned around and looked at him. Randolph Scott, Jack thought at once. That's just who he looks like. But in spite of the rangy and uncompromising lines of his face, the real Randolph Scott had had an undeniable look of heroism. If his good looks had been harsh, they had also been part of a face that could smile. This man looked both bored and somehow crazy. And with real fright, Jack realized the man was looking at him, at Jack. Nor had he simply turned around during the commercial to see who might be in the bar. He had turned around to look at Jack. Jack knew this was so. The phone. The ringing phone. With a tremendous effort, Jack pulled his gaze away. He looked back into the bubble front of the juke and saw his own frightened face hovering ghost-like over the records inside. The telephone began to shriek on the wall. The man at the left end of the bar looked at it and then looked back at Jack, who stood frozen by the jukebox with his bottle of Windex in one hand and a rag in the other, his hair stiffening, his skin freezing. "If it's that asshole again, I'm going to get me a whistle to start blowing down the phone when he calls Smokey," Laurie was saying as she walked toward it. "I swear to God I am." She might have been an actress in a play, and all the customers, extras, paid the standard SAG rate of $35 a day. The only two real people in the world were him and this dreadful cowboy with the big hands and the eyes Jack could not quite see. Suddenly, shockingly, the cowboy mouthed these words, "Get your ass home," and winked. The phone stopped ringing even as Laurie stretched out her hand to it. Randolph Scott turned around, drained his glass, and yelled, "Bring me another tapper, okay?" "I'll be damned," Laurie said. "That phone's got the ghosts." Later on, in the storeroom, Jack asked Laurie who the guy was who looked like Randolph Scott.
"Who looks like who?" she asked.
"An old cowboy actor. He was sitting down at the end of the bar." She shrugged. "They all look the same to me, Jack. Just a bunch of swinging dicks out for a good time. On Thursday nights, they usually pay for it with the little woman's beano money." "He calls beers tappers." Her eyes lit.
"Oh, yeah, him. He looks mean."
She said this last with actual appreciation, as if admiring the straightness of his nose or the whiteness of his smile.
"Who is he?"
"I don't know his name," Laurie said. "He's only been around last week or two. I guess the mill must be hiring again."
"For Christ's sake, Jack, did I tell you to run me out a keg or not?"
Jack had been in the process of walking one of the big kegs of bush into the foot of the hand dolly. Because his weight and the keg's foot were so close, it was an act requiring a good deal of careful balancing. When Smokey shouted from the doorway, Laurie screamed and Jack jumped. He lost control of the keg, and it went over on its side, the cap shooting out like a champagne cork, beer following in a white gold jet. Smokey was still shouting at him, but Jack could only stare at the beer, frozen, until Smokey popped him one. When he got back out to the tap room, perhaps 20 minutes later, holding a Kleenex against his swelling nose, Randolph Scott had been gone.
"I'm six. John Benjamin Sawyer is six. Six."
Jack shook his head, trying to clear this steady, repeating thought out, as the rangy millhand who was not a millhand leaned closer and closer, his eyes yellow and somehow scaly. It blinked, a rapid, milky, swimming blink, and Jack realized it had nictitating membranes over its eyeballs.
"You were supposed to get gone," it whispered again, and reached toward Jack with hands that were beginning to twist and plait and harden.
The door banged open, letting in a raucous flood of the Oak Ridge boys.
"Jack, if you don't quit lollygagging, I'm going to have to make you sorry," Smokey said from behind Randolph Scott.
Scott stepped backward. No melting, hardening hooves here. His hands were just hands again, big and powerful, their backs crisscrossed with prominent ridged veins. There was another milky, swirling sort of blink that didn't involve the eyelids at all. And then the man's eyes were not yellow, but a simple, faded blue. He gave Jack a final glance and then headed toward the men's room. Smokey came toward Jack now, his paper cap tipped forward, his narrow weasel's head slightly inclined, his lips parted to show his alligator teeth.
"Don't make me speak to you again," Smokey said. "This is your last warning, and don't you think I don't mean it?"
As it had against Osmond, Jack's fury suddenly rose up. That sort of fury, closely linked as it is to a sense of hopeless injustice, is perhaps never as strong as it is at 12. College students sometimes think they feel it, but it is usually little more than an intellectual echo. This time, it boiled over.
"I'm not your dog, so don't you treat me like I am," Jack said, and took a step toward Smokey Updike on legs that were still rubbery with fear.
Surprised, possibly even flabbergasted by Jack's totally unexpected anger, Smokey backed up a step.
"Jack, I'm warning you."
"No, man, I'm warning you," Jack heard himself say. "I'm not Laurie. I don't want to be hit. And if you hit me, I'm going to hit you back or something." Smokey Updike's discomposure was only momentary. He had most assuredly not seen everything, not living in Oatley, he hadn't, but he thought he had. And even for a minor leaguer, sometimes assurance can be enough. He reached out to grab Jack's collar.
Don't you smart off to me, Jack, he said, drawing Jack close. As long as you're an Oatly, my dog is just what you are. As long as you're an Oatly, I'll pet you when I want, and I'll beat you when I want.
He administered a single neck-snapping shake. Jack bit his tongue and cried out. Hectic spots of anger now glowed in Smokey's pale cheeks like cheap rouge.
You may not think that is so right now, but Jack, it is. As long as you're an Oatly, you're my dog, and you'll be an Oatly until I decide to let you go, and we might as well start getting that learned right now.
He pulled his fist back. For a moment, the three naked 60-watt bulbs which hung in this narrow hallway sparkled crazily on the diamond chips of the horseshoe-shaped pinky ring he wore. Then the fist pistoned forward and slammed into the side of Jack's face. He was driven backward into the graffiti-covered wall, the side of his face first flaring and then going numb. The taste of his own blood washed into his mouth. Smokey looked at him, the close, judgmental stare of a man who might be thinking about buying a heifer or a lottery number. He must not have seen the expression he wanted to see in Jack's eye, because he grabbed the dazed boy again, presumably the better to center him for a second shot. At that moment, a woman shrieked from the tap.
No, Glenn, no!
There was a tangle of bellowing male voices, most of them alarmed. Another woman screamed, a high, drilling sound. Then a gunshot.
Shit on toast, Smokey cried, enunciating each word as carefully as an actor on a Broadway stage.
He threw Jack back against the wall, whirled, and slammed out through the swinging door. The gun went off again, and there was a scream of pain. Jack was sure of only one thing. The time had come to get out. Not at the end of tonight's shift, or tomorrow's, or on Sunday morning. Right now. The uproar seemed to be quieting down. There were no sirens, so maybe nobody had gotten shot. But, Jack remembered, cold, the mill hand who looked like Randolph Scott was still down in the men's can. Jack went into the chilly, beer-smelling storeroom, knelt by the kegs, and felt around for his pack. Again there was that suffocating certainty as his fingers encountered nothing but thin air and the dirty concrete floor that one of them, Smokey or Laurie, had seen him hide the pack and had taken it. All the better to keep you in Oatly, my dear. Then relief, almost as suffocating as the fear, when his fingers touched the nylon. Jack donned the pack and looked longingly toward the loading door at the back of the storeroom. He would much rather use that door. He didn't want to go down to the fire door at the end of the hall. That was too close to the men's bathroom. But if he opened the loading door, a red light would go on at the bar. Even if Smokey was still sorting out the ruckus on the floor, Laurie would see that light and tell him. So, he went to the door which gave on the back corridor. He eased it open a crack and applied one eye. The corridor was empty. All right, that was cool. Randolph Scott had tapped a kidney and gone back to where the action was while Jack was getting his backpack. Great. Yeah, except maybe he's still in there. You want to meet him in the hall, Jackie? Want to watch his eyes turn yellow again? Wait until you're sure. But he couldn't do that, because Smokey would see he wasn't out in the tap, helping Laurie and Gloria swab tables or behind the bar unloading the dishwasher. He would come back here to finish teaching Jack what his place was in the great scheme of things. So what? Get going. Maybe he's in there waiting for you, Jackie. Maybe he's going to jump out just like a big bad Jack in the box. The lady or the tiger? Smokey or the mill hand? Jack hesitated a moment longer in an agony of indecision. That the man with the yellow eyes was still in the bathroom was a possibility. That Smokey would be back was a certainty. Jack opened the door and stepped out into the narrow hallway. The pack on his back seemed to gain weight, an eloquent accusation of his planned escape to anyone who might see it. He started down the hallway, moving grotesquely on tiptoe, in spite of the thundering music and the roar of the crowd, his heart hammering in his chest. I was six. Jackie was six. So what? Why did that keep coming back? Six. The corridor seemed longer. It was like walking on a treadmill. The fire door at the far end seemed to draw closer only by agonizing degrees. Sweat now coated his brow and his upper lip. His gaze flicked steadily toward the door to the right with the black outline of a dog on it. Beneath this outline was the word Pointers, and at the end of the corridor a door of fading, peeling red. The sign on the door said, "Emergency use only. Alarm will sound." In fact, the alarm bell had been broken for 2 years. Laurie had told him so when Jack had hesitated about using the door to take out the trash. Finally, almost there, directly opposite Pointers. "He's in there, I know he is, and if he jumps out, I'll scream. I'll... Jack put out a trembling right hand and touched the crash bar of the emergency door. It felt blessedly cool to his touch. For one moment, he really believed he would simply fly out of the pitcher plant and into the night, free. Then the door behind him suddenly banged open, the door to Setters, and a hand grabbed his backpack. Jack uttered a high-pitched, despairing shriek of a trapped animal and lunged at the emergency door, heedless of the pack and the magic juice inside it. If the straps had broken, he would have simply gone fleeing through the trashy, weedy, vacant lot behind the tap and never mind anything else. But the straps were tough nylon and didn't break. The door opened a little way, revealing a brief, dark wedge of the night, and then thumped shut again. Jack was pulled into the women's room. He was whirled around and then thrown backward. If he had hit the wall dead on, the bottle of magic juice would undoubtedly have shattered in the pack, drenching his few clothes and good old Rand McNally with the odor of rotting grapes. Instead, he hit the room's one wash basin with the small of his back. The pain was giant, excruciating. The mill hand was walking toward him slowly, hitching up his jeans with hands that had begun to twist and thicken. "You were supposed to be gone, kid," he said, his voice roughening, becoming at every moment more like the snarl of an animal. Jack began to edge to his left, his eyes never leaving the man's face. His eyes now seemed almost transparent, not just yellow, but lighted from within. The eyes of a hideous Halloween jack-o'-lantern. "But you can trust old Elroy," the cowboy thing said, and now it grinned to reveal a mouthful of curving teeth, some of them jaggedly broken off, some black with rot. Jack screamed. "Ah, you can trust Elroy," it said, its words now hardly discernible from a dog-like growl. "He ain't gonna hurt you too bad. You'll be all right," it growled, moving toward Jack. "You'll be all right, oh yeah, you'll..." It continued to talk, but Jack could no longer tell what it was saying. Now it was only snarling. Jack's foot hit the tall waste can by the door. As the cowboy thing reached for him with its hoof-like hands, Jack grabbed the can and threw it. The can bounced off the Elroy thing's chest. Jack tore open the bathroom door and lunged to the left, toward the emergency door. He slammed into the crash bar, aware that Elroy was right behind him. He lurched into the dark behind the Oatly tap. There was a colony of overloaded garbage cans to the right of the door. Jack blindly swept three of them behind him, heard them clash and rattle, and then a howl of fury as Elroy stumbled into them. He whirled in time to see the thing go down. There was even a moment to realize, oh, dear Jesus, a tail, it's got something like a tail, that the thing was now almost entirely an animal. Golden light fell from its eyes in weird rays, like bright light falling through twin keyholes. Jack backed away from it, pulling the pack from his back, trying to undo the catches with fingers which felt like blocks of wood, his mind a roaring confusion. Jackie was six. God help me, Speedy. Jackie was six. God, of thoughts and incoherent pleas. The thing snarled and flailed at the garbage cans. Jack saw one hoof hand go up and then come whistling down, splitting the side of one corrugated metal can in a jagged slash a yard long. It got up again, stumbled, almost fell, and then began to lurch toward Jack, its snarling, rippling face now almost at chest level. And somehow, through its barking growls, he was able to make out what it was saying. "Now I'm not just going to ream you, little chicken. Now I'm going to kill you after." Hearing it with his ears or in his head? It didn't matter. The space between this world and that had shrunk from a universe to a mere membrane. The Elroy thing snarled and came toward him, now unsteady and awkward on its rear feet, its clothes bulging in all the wrong places, its tongue swinging from its fanged mouth. Here was the vacant lot behind Smoky Updike's Oatly Tap. Yes, here it was at last, choked with weeds and blown trash, a rusty bedspring here, the grill of a 1957 Ford over there, and a ghastly sickle moon like a bent bone in the sky overhead, turning every shard of broken glass into a dead and staring eye. And this hadn't begun in New Hampshire, had it? No, it hadn't begun when his mother got sick, or with the appearance of Lester Parker. It had begun when Jackie was six, when we all lived in California and no one lived anywhere else, and Jackie was... He fumbled at the straps of his pack. It came again, seeming almost to dance, for a moment reminding him of some animated Disney cartoon figure in the chancy moonlight. Crazily, Jack began to laugh. The thing snarled and leaped at him. The swipe of those heavy hoof claws again missed him by barest inches as he danced back through the weeds and litter. The Elroy thing came down on the bedspring and somehow became entangled in it. Howling, snapping white gobbets of foam into the air, it pulled and twisted and lunged, one foot buried deep in the rusty coils. Jack groped inside his pack for the bottle. He dug past socks and dirty undershorts and a wadded, fragrant pair of jeans. He seized the neck of the bottle and yanked it out. The Elroy thing split the air with a howl of rage, finally pulling free of the bedspring. Jack hit the cindery, weedy, scruffy ground and rolled over, the last two fingers of his left hand hooked around one pack strap, his right hand holding the bottle. He worked at the cap with the thumb and forefinger of his left hand, the pack dangling and swinging. The cap spun off. "Can it follow me?" he wondered incoherently, tipping the bottle to his lips. "When I go, do I punch some kind of hole through the middle of things? Can it follow me through and finish me on the other side?" Jack's mouth filled with that rotten, dead grape taste. He gagged, his throat closing, seeming to actually reverse direction. Now that awful taste filled his sinuses and nasal passages as well, and he uttered a deep, shaking groan. He could hear the Elroy thing screaming now, but the scream seemed far away, as if it were on one end of the Oatly Tunnel, and he, Jack, were falling rapidly toward the other end. And this time there was a sense of falling, and he thought, "Oh, my God, what if I just flip my stupid self over a cliff or off a mountain over there?" He held on to the pack and the bottle, his eyes screwed desperately shut, waiting for whatever might happen next, Elroy thing or no Elroy thing, territories or oblivion. And the thought which had haunted him all night came swinging back like a dancing carousel horse, Silver Lady, maybe Ella Speed. He caught it and wrote it down in a cloud of the magic juice's awful smell, holding it, waiting for whatever would happen next, feeling his clothes change on his body. Six. Oh, yes, when we were all six and nobody was anything else, and it was California. Who blows that sax, Daddy? Is it Dexter Gordon? Or is it what does Mom mean when she says we're living on a fault line? And where do you go, Daddy? You and Uncle Morgan. Oh, Daddy, sometimes he looks at you like there's a fault line in his head and an earthquake going on behind his eyes, and you're dying in it. Oh, Daddy! Falling, twisting, turning in the middle of limbo, in the middle of a smell like a purple cloud. Jack Sawyer, John Benjamin Sawyer. Jackie was six when it started to happen. And who blew that sax, Daddy? Who blew it when I was six, when Jackie was six, when Jackie... Chapter 11. The Death of Jerry Bledsoe. Was six... When it really started, Daddy, when the engines that eventually pulled him to Oatly and beyond began to chug away. There had been loud saxophone music. Six. Jackie was six. At first his attention had been entirely on the toy his father had given him, a scale model of a London taxi. The toy car was heavy as a brick, and on the smooth wooden floors of the new office, a good push sent it rumbling straight across the room. Late afternoon, first grade all the way on the other side of August, a neat new car that rolled like a tank on the strip of bare wood behind the couch, a contented, relaxed feeling in the air-conditioned office, no more work to do, no more phone calls that couldn't wait until the next day. Jack pushed the heavy toy taxi down the strip of bare wood, barely able to hear the rumbling of the solid rubber tires under the soloing of a saxophone. The black car struck one of the legs of the couch, spun sideways, and stopped. Jack crawled down, and Uncle Morgan had parked himself in one of the chairs on the other side of the couch. Each man nursed a drink. Soon they'd put down their glasses, switch off the turntable and the amplifier, and go downstairs to their cars. When we were all six and nobody was anything else, and it was California, "Who's playing that sax?" he heard Uncle Morgan ask, and half in a reverie heard that familiar voice in a new way, something whispery and hidden in Morgan Sloat's voice coiled into Jackie's ear. He touched the top of the toy taxi, and his fingers were as cold as if it were of ice, not English steel. "That's Dexter Gordon, is who that is," his father answered. His voice was as lazy and friendly as it always was, and Jack slipped his hand around the heavy taxi. "Good record. Daddy plays the horn. It is a nice old record, isn't it? I'll have to look for it." And then Jack thought he knew what that strangeness in Uncle Morgan's voice was all about. Uncle Morgan didn't really like jazz at all. He just pretended to in front of Jack's father. Jack had known this fact about Morgan Sloat for most of his childhood.